Welcome to the Agency in Focus, NASA, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
It may not launch for another year and a half, but already the ground crew is preparing for the first test flight of NASA's new heavy lift rocket. The Space Launch System, or SLS, is still being perfected. Earlier, we heard from the development director. Find that interview at federalnewsradio.com, search Agency in Focus. I also spoke with Charlie Blackwell Thompson, the launch director for SLS and the Orion capsule it will carry aloft. We started with the collaboration between the development and build team and the launch and flight people.
We absolutely collaborate throughout the process. There is no real, I'll say, handoff between the two. You know, I work on behalf of ESD or on behalf of Bill, and my specific area of assignment is to plan our launch countdown and then on launch day to go implement or execute that launch countdown. But all the way through the process, there's a partnership between the flight programs and ESD as they work to develop the flight hardware, and then for myself, as I develop the plans for launch countdown, how we're going to put the countdown together, how we're going to train our team, and then ultimately how we're going to go execute on launch day.
And does this process pretty much date back to the late 1950s?
Well, I would say that we have taken lessons learned from historical programs, certainly, and looked at how we can leverage those things into our launch countdown. Many of us came from shuttle, not all. We certainly have many new members on our team, but we try to look back at what are those best practices, what are those lessons learned, those things that we felt worked really well, and make sure that we incorporate those. And then the wonderful thing, you know, I came to shuttle probably about, I don't know, a third to halfway through the program. And so, you know, it was an operational program and things were kind of set. To me, one of the really neat things about where we are in this endeavor is that you have an opportunity as you're developing the flight hardware, as you're developing your processes for the first time, you have an opportunity to shape those things. And some of the things that we couldn't change maybe on historical programs because you were already operational, you have an opportunity, you know, from kind of to build it from the ground up. And there's something really fulfilling about that for me.
Any examples of things that you learned in the shuttle program that you and Bill Hill maybe decided, you know what, if we did this, then this would be better?
Certainly. There's a lot of them. If I were to look specifically at Launch Countdown, one of the things that I would tell you is that as you look across Launch Countdowns, there are hole points that we had back in shuttle. And I know that sounds like a really simple thing is, you know, why do you have a hold in the Launch Countdown? Or it's just a place where you stop. But it is, as simple as it sounds, it is a place where you kind of stop for a moment. It's a catch-up point in case you're behind. Because as you're probably aware, you know, during launch, there are certain operations that if you have bad weather that can get held up and you can get a little behind. And so having those catch-up points is a great thing. You also, as you enter into certain milestones, you want to make sure that your team is synced and that they're all ready for those milestones, things like tanking, things like getting into terminal count. And so in shuttle, we had a number of hold points throughout the countdown.
I guess your background at one point in your career and in your collegiate career was software validation and verification. And in software development, they have the concept of breakpoints, where you stop and maybe examine the code and so forth. It almost sounds like an extension of that concept.
It is somewhat like that. And yes, I do have a background in software verification and validation. And I promise I'll come right back to what we learned in shuttle. But just to speak a moment about that, you know, that's how I ended up at Kennedy Space Center is part of my training in college. One of the things I was really interested in was testing software. And as luck would have it, as part of the hiring, getting ready for return to flight for STS-26R, the return to flight of Space Shuttle Discovery after Challenger, there was a need for some folks to come and test flight software. And so that was something that really interested me, and I had an opportunity to come do that. And then over the course of time, I've had many different roles in the Launch Control Center. But certainly, you know, that first one was something to me as a young lady right out of college. It was very exciting being a part of America's space program and having an opportunity to test some of that software.
That's interesting because software testing doesn't generally inflame the hearts of people that are interested in technology. But in the case of launch software, it's really life and death in many cases, the quality and reliability of that software, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we depend upon the software in the Launch Control Center, as well as the software that is in the flight computers, to work, to do exactly what it's supposed to do. Timing is critical. And so going through the testing regime and ensuring that it works exactly the way you expect it, and not only for the nominal part of launch, but also, you know, when we scrub a launch countdown, or when we decide that we're going to stand down and come back another day, there's a certain set of steps that we need to run to ensure that we're, you know, go through our, what we call our safing exercises. And so there are many different facets of that software testing that we do here at Kennedy.
We are speaking with Charlie Blackwell Thompson, launch director for the first launch of the Space Launch System and the Orion at NASA. And I just want to pull on the software thread for just another moment. Give us a sense of the languages and programming environments that are used for this type of work, because, you know, other federal agencies that do more type of commercial work are struggling with legacy software. Has NASA updated the environments and languages it uses since the shuttle days and even earlier?
Certainly, it has changed. Back in shuttle, our applications were written in something called GOL, and it was a language. It was very readable. I would say that folks that, and I am not one of them, I, back in the day, was a pretty good tester of software, which was, you know, seeing, does it meet the requirement set, and how can we go break it? I would never say that I was a really good coder, but certainly in today's work environment, folks that can write software and do that well are in high demand. It is a skill set that is not only needed here at NASA and that we use here at NASA, but really across the industry.
And let's face it, good testing people can force coders to be better, just knowing that who's going to be testing it down the line.
Absolutely.
All right, let's get to the SLS and Orion itself. What's the status of the first countdown in terms of calendar and in terms of the program physically?
We are making progress every single day. We are managing to a December 2019 launch date with our launch occurring in FY20. As far as our launch countdown itself and the preparations for that, what I would tell you is that we have our launch, first off, there's the way we put our launch countdown together was we began looking at what is the work that needs to happen. How do we go configure these ground systems, configure the flight systems, make sure that we have them where we need them to be for the various stages of launch. A lot of times folks think about launch and they think about those last few minutes of count. But our launch count spans about 2 days. And so there's quite a bit of work that happens over that time. So we are in the process right now with my team of developing those launch countdown procedures. And of course, that's all driven by your requirements. Those requirements come from our engineering team and our flight programs. And so we're putting all that together. That work is coming along nicely from a launch count perspective. We also have our schedules and our training regime for the team. We recently completed, just a couple months ago, our first cryo-loading demonstration. And what I mean by that is we actually had the Launch Control Center configured. We were running against a simulator, but we went through our cryo-loading or our tanking operations that we'll do in countdown. So we've already started our simulations and our demonstrations. Those really start in earnest next year when we get into our training regime, but some of that stuff is starting today. And so from a launch countdown development perspective, I would tell you we are making very good progress with our procedures, with our schedules, with the training of our teams. Now, we still have work to do there, certainly, and a lot of that work will start in earnest next year with the training in particular.
Charlie Blackwell Thompson is launch director for NASA's SLS and Orion capsule, scheduled for early 2020. Hear more about the details leading up to that launch after this quick break. I'm Tom Tamman.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
We're speaking with Charlie Blackwell Thompson, Launch Director for NASA's Space Launch System and Orion capsule. And here's another detailed question, and this is something that has become part of the national background consciousness over the decades. But as it counts down and we hear those seconds stated on television and so forth, what is the purpose of the precise moment, second, within a given day of a launch? Is it simply to force the discipline of making sure it ever gets off the ground? Or is there a reason for this day, this hour, this minute, this second to light the candle?
There is absolutely something behind that day and minute. And we have a team of folks at Johnson Space Center that look very closely at the flight aspects of the vehicle, when precisely we need to launch it based on where we're going. And there's a lot of things that go that are taken into account with that. It's not just the trajectory and again, our destination. It's also, you know, various requirements that we may have for when we're going to land. And so there's a lot that goes into the development of the launch window. And so you see that on different days, those launch windows change, you know, slightly. Sometimes they actually see some more significant changes, but that's when you see some variability in the launch windows. And so the flight control team at Johnson Space Center, the flight director in particular, passes that information over to our launch control team. And then we have a set of parameters that we would say that we manage to. And part of that is the opening of the window, any hold time that we have available. We call them limiting constraints, which means that there are various things that we're evaluating as we go through the launch countdown to make sure that we are targeting that launch window that the flight control team is looking for.
And do you have several windows planned for a given launch? Because if a thunderstorm comes in or it gets too cold overnight, whatever, you can't launch. And so you already have backups.
That's a great question. We absolutely have backup days available to us. One of the nice things about our launch windows right now is that they tend to be longer. If you remember back in shuttle when we were going to the International Space Station, our launch windows tended to be about 10 minutes long. So you had a very short window. These tend to be a couple of hours long. They certainly vary by day because there's parameters that you take into account in that development. But a longer launch window gives you opportunity to allow some of those weather, if we have a quick passing storm, it allows you an opportunity to maybe let that get out of the way and then have an opportunity to launch before the end of the window. We don't have multiple windows on the same day. So in the event that we don't launch, we would stand down for 48 hours for Exploration Mission 1, and we'd come back and try again 2 days later.
And for this initial launch, whether it's the end of 2019 or into the new date of 2020 some point, will there be an active payload, or is it simply a test with no real cargo on board?
So we are testing out a number of things as part of Exploration Mission 1. The first is SLS, its performance. We are also testing out Orion, ensuring that it's ready for crew on a follow-on mission. And in addition to that, we also have a number of small satellites or CubeSats that will be deployed along our route to the moon. So we're accomplishing quite a bit with this first mission.
Charlie Blackwell Thompson is launch director for NASA's SLS and Orion capsule, scheduled for early 2020. After this break, we learn more about Blackwell Thompson herself and how she became NASA's first woman launch director. I'm Tom Temin.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
We're talking to Charlie Blackwell Thompson, launch director for NASA's Space Launch System and Orion capsule. And I wanted to talk about you and your career a little bit here first. Before you became the launch director, you were a test director and then chief of the test directors. What is that exactly, and how does it lead to becoming a launch director?
Yes, I was a NASA test director on the Space Shuttle program, and the NASA test director on Shuttle executed the launch countdown, or were one of the folks that executed the launch countdown on behalf of the launch director. And so a lot of times folks think that, you know, the launch director does a whole lot of talking on the net and runs a whole lot of steps, but they really don't. They're kind of standing back. They're watching the progress of the launch countdown, and they're seeing where we are relative to the timeline, how we're performing against what we call launch commit criteria, which is what we evaluate against to determine if we're ready to go fly. And the NASA test director is one of those voices that you hear on the loops that is kicking off and executing the work. And so I had the opportunity during Shuttle to have that job. It was a wonderful, wonderful job, working with the Shuttle launch team and being a part of those countdowns. But that was part of my job. And then the chief NASA test director, their responsibility is to kind of look across the test management from both the launch activities as well as some of the landing ops once the space shuttle was back at the SLF, and to kind of provide that management view of how the work is all coming together. And so the chief NASA test director really worked a lot with the launch director as part of the launch countdowns.
And what about the flight director? Where does that person fit into this pantheon?
Oh, well, the flight director is responsible for the flight phase. And so the launch director and the flight director work very closely together, planning they're very focused on the mission operations, but they're involved with us in the launch operations as well, because there's that handoff between the launch director and the flight director with respect to responsibilities at T0. And so the launch director is responsible for those launch operations down to booster ignition, and then you have the handoff to the flight director. And so certainly in the planning phase, we work very closely together. We did back in Shuttle, and we continue to do that today.
And you've mentioned a couple of times, and a lot of the literature and stories about this mention the cryogenic loading, that is putting fuel into the tanks that I guess is very, very cold. And that seems to be a big emphasis of something that sounds routine. Why is it not routine, and what is the criticality of fueling this whole thing?
Well, the fueling operations are significant for a number of reasons. First, it is a commitment that we are going to make a run at a launch that particular day. If we think that for whatever reason, because we have problems or other things, that we're not going to pursue launch on that day, then you typically don't tank the vehicle. So the first part of it is that it really is that no kidding, we're going to go make a run at launch. And so it's a milestone as part of the countdown. The other reason that it's significant is that we are loading these cryogenic fuel and oxidizer into the core stage as part of our launch countdown operations. And so what happens is that it's a very tightly choreographed loading sequence, and you're loading liquid oxygen, or LOX as we call it, and liquid hydrogen. And you're not only loading the core stage for this vehicle, but you're also loading the upper stage as well. And so there's a choreography between how you go load those two commodities and then how you load the core stage and then the upper stage. And so that takes a fair amount of time to go do that. And then once we come out of what we call cryogenic loading operations for EM1, because we don't have a flight crew, there's just a very short amount of time between when we complete that and when we get to what we call replenish, which means the tanks are full and we're just kind of topping off as we have boil off. There's only a very short amount of time, just a little over 2 hours before we go launch.
We're speaking with Charlie Blackwell Thompson, launch director for the first launch of the Space Launch System and Orion at NASA. Let's get back to your career then for a moment. You worked for Boeing after college. Tell us what you did and, you know, how you ended up at NASA.
Well, I had an opportunity when I was a senior in college to I had the good fortune to interview for that software test job that I talked about earlier. And at the time, it was McDonnell Douglas was responsible for the payload processing here at the Cape. And they were looking for folks to go test software, to go test flight and ground software. And so because I had an interest in that, I had an opportunity to interview with them at school and then had a plant trip down here. And as part of that plant trip, I was actually toured through the firing room because they wanted to kind of give me a feel for, hey, you know, here's where some of this ground software will run and this is the criticality of it. And, you know, part of that was through firing room one. And as I walked through there, they were testing Space Shuttle Discovery, getting her ready for return to flight. And there was something special about being in that control room that really resonated with me and made me want to be a part of that team. And so, you know, I was fortunate enough to get that job back then with McDonnell Douglas that later transitioned to Boeing. And I worked in payloads and in software and then in avionics and then in payload integration for a number of years before coming to NASA.
And you are the first female launch director at NASA. What are your thoughts on girls and young women going into STEM study and then later into STEM-related careers?
Well, I encourage all young people to consider the STEM field. I had a teacher back in high school that was really instrumental for me in determining sort of my path, because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do when I was in high school or what I wanted to study in college. And so I had a wonderful high school teacher who said, you know, Charlie, you ought to think about going into engineering. And I asked him, Doc, what would I do with an engineering degree? And he said, you know, what couldn't you do with an engineering degree? And his words couldn't have been more true for me. And so I share that story with young folks, and particularly with young women, because, you know, studying the STEM field, you never know what doors will be opened. And some folks know exactly where they want to go in their careers, and I applaud that. That is absolutely wonderful. But there's a lot of young people that were like me that didn't quite have that exact path. And so I can say that my engineering degree and my engineering study have really produced opportunities that I couldn't have imagined. You know, I look back over the 30 years that I've been at Kennedy Space Center and the things that I've been able to be a part of. And the word that comes to mind is just, I am blessed. I got to work on many different payloads, space lab program, the International Space Station assembly elements, Hubble Space Telescope, the servicing missions to Hubble, and then had an opportunity to move over to NASA in the 2004 timeframe and become a NASA test director as we prepared for return to flight after Columbia, and then to be able to you know, be on that launch team for and play some role in the launch team for every mission from return to flight until the end of the program in 2011. I thought I had, in every single one of those, I thought I had the greatest job. And when someone would ask me, I would tell them that I have the greatest job in the entire world. I felt that way all along the way, and I still feel that way today, to be given the opportunity to be a part of the exploration missions, the planning of the launch countdown, the leader of the launch team, is an incredible honor and a blessing.
Charlie Blackwell Thompson is launch director for NASA's Space Launch System and Orion capsule, scheduled to lift off in early 2020. We'll post this interview at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus NASA, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.
IT modernization can transform your agency. Accelerate your path to transformation with Cisco and Dell EMC solutions from Iron Bow Technologies. Their team is dedicated to delivering on the promises of IT transformation. Experience improved outcomes, better efficiencies, increased security, and more flexibility. Accelerate your path to transformation with Cisco and Dell EMC solutions. Explore your options with Iron Bow. Visit ironbow.com/modernize. That's ironbow.com/modernize.
You know, the mantra in Washington is follow the money. Everybody says it, hardly anybody does it. But we do. Every week on Your Turn with Mike Causey. Whether it's your pay raise, a major change to your retirement package, or the chances of layoffs, we're on it. Because we really do follow the money, and it's your money. Give us a listen Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., or download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Your Turn.
The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, weekday morning starting at 6 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Search Federal Drive.
The following program is produced and furnished by Sean Kelly, who is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Cyber Chat with Sean Kelly, former CISO at EPA and former deputy CIO at Veterans Affairs on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Cyber Chat, where government leaders come to discuss the hottest cyber topics affecting us today. Now your host, Sean Kelly.
Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Paul Tibbetts, Program Executive Officer for Financial Management Business Transformation, FMBT, at the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. Tibbetts, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Sir, FMBT, what is it? What's it going to do in a nutshell?
As the title implies, Financial Management Business Transformation. At the heart of the program, I would say our intent is to implement federal best practices in finance and acquisition. Obviously, there are a lot of information technology dependencies in that. We have to take out our old Enterprise Resource Planning System, ERP, FMS, which some of you may know, and replace it with a new one. Momentum is the commercial product, so major IT component to this program. But maybe we'll get to it later. The financial and acquisition best practices is what we're really after. And we're putting a great deal of energy into business process reengineering on the front end of this program to make sure that happens.
So eventually, end state is all financial management systems will be under one system umbrella and will talk to each other.
Well, in a certain sense, they won't have to talk to each other because they will be in one system. I mean, that's absolutely right. There are many feeder systems, though, that do other things for the department, process claims, estimate veteran eligibility for compensation, for example, which also have a financial implication. So those feeder systems will all have to continue to operate for their other purpose that's not financial, but we will have to capture the financial implications from them. So that's interface work. And we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 120 or so interfaces that have to be modified from their current connection over to the new connection to our new system.
Gotcha. So what do you see as the cyber risk for consolidating financial systems under one managed service?
Well, in a certain sense, the cyber risk is only going to get lower because we're actually replacing an existing ERP with a new ERP. So in that sense, there was a lot of consolidation already. We're going to a more modern system with stronger security controls built into it. We're going to a cloud environment. We're cognizant of all the NIST controls that are relevant to a cloud environment. Our cloud environment, if we need it, is FedRAMP certified as high, although it doesn't look like we'll have to exercise quite all of that degree of protection. We're paying attention to all of the NIST controls that FedRAMP requires. So I would say our cybersecurity posture, based on where we're coming from, if anything, is going to be better than it was before, we're reducing risk, not adding risk.
Because it's built today for the security standards of today, not the ones that were built when these original systems were put in place.
That's exactly right.
So you did a lot of work when I was at the VA in putting together the systems of record, which, you know, now we kind of classify into high value assets and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so that was very helpful to me in my roles, is looking at the systems that fell into my portfolio and what were labeled as urgent and all those kind of things. So I can see how this would go forward. But is the government really ready about to bring on a managed service? You're working on this. It's one of the first major ones within VA. Are they really ready to go to a managed service and give up that kind of control?
The government, in our case, again, I can't speak for all of government. My experience is obviously recently limited to the VA and before that DOD. But I'm speaking from that perspective. But from a VA perspective, absolutely. And I would say, in a certain sense, long overdue, perhaps. Now, for those of us who have had some familiarity with the Navy, this is like turning a carrier battle group 90 degrees. So it's, there's some challenges here, right? You can feel the rudder there kind of shaking when you do this, turn the thing. Obviously, a lot of new processes have to be put in place, and great. Underlying the new processes, even more importantly, I would say, are the new knowledge, skills, and abilities that all of us have to learn to make that shift. Nonetheless, because of a lot of reasons, the flexibility that cloud offers, managed services, but in our case, cloud, commercial cloud, the flexibility that it offers, the economies of scale that it offers, the surge capacity that it offers, the flexibility for the future, quite frankly, of whatever our future service business models are in the department, all those things are really warrant movement towards both cloud and, managed services in general and cloud in particular. Economic, too, I might add one more thing from an economies of scale perspective. We want to get out of a capital expenditure model, a CapEx model, where we buy and own something. Big investment spike on the front end. You can never find enough money to fund that investment spike, et cetera, et cetera. We want to move from that to an OpEx model where we start off with an operational expense, which is basically operations and sustainment level. So you get rid of the capital investment on the front end. And technical debt for yourself either, which buying and owning does on day one.
Agreed.
Day number two, you're already in technical debt.
Like buying a car.
I mean, I've done a fair amount of reading on that situation too. And because of the number of lines of code in a F-150 Ford pickup truck is astounding. And right now, really, it behooves people to think about even automobiles as a transportation expense, not something you can own for 10 years. It's going to be out of maintenance and everything else and out of fashion in a technical sense in less than a year.
I agree. And let's talk more about that when we come back. My guest today is Dr. Paul Tibbetts, Program Executive Officer for Financial Management Business Transformation, FMBT, at the Department of Veterans Affairs. I am Sean Kelly, and this is Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Yesterday's information is already well known. In fact, your agency is currently operating on it. Adapting to tomorrow's information and implementing it with foresight, that's the reason you have Chief in your title. Chief Information Officers stay on top of federal IT changes with Jason Miller's Ask the CIO.
Find out how agencies are tackling challenges like cyber, cloud, regulation. Find out what's working and what's not.
Ask the CIO. Listen, read, engage. New episodes posted weekly at federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. My guest today is Dr. Paul Tibbetts, Program Executive Officer for Financial Management Business Transformation, FMBT, at the Department of Veteran Affairs. Paul, we talked a little bit about the churn of change in the VA and mm-hmm. going to a managed service. Mm-hmm. So we've had employees that have grown up with a certain technology or grown up in a certain environment that isn't the same cyber environment, the same environment we have today. How do you see those employees embracing this change as far as the new skill sets they'll have to learn?
Well, based on my experience and the circle of influence that I operate in, I'd say very good. The staff that I deal with are all very excited about moving the VA forward, being actual participants in the VA efforts to modernize itself, including the movement to managed services. We are baking cybersecurity into the program from the ground up, taking proper consideration of NIST controls and those that are relevant to a FedRAMP certified environment. And we believe in doing that. All of us strongly believe that in doing that, we have a real role to play in enhancing services to veterans. But in our case, even more directly, creating the transparency and resource stewardship necessary to discharge our responsibilities to taxpayers and oversight bodies. So I think everyone's very excited to be, in a very meaningful way, engaged in that transition. And the training opportunities, you could call them training obligations, but in a certain sense, the people I deal with look at them as opportunities, which are preparing them better not only for future roles in government, if they choose that, or better roles outside of government if they choose to go outside of government. So it's a great launching platform from a personal perspective for the professional growth and development of the staff.
I agree. You have a very strong background. When I met you, you were in enterprise architecture. How does that help cybersecurity in the enterprise architecture world?
Right. So thank you. We've spent... I've worked very closely with our Office of Information Security, particularly Dom Cassatt, Royce Allen, on the initiative that they actually started, which is called the Risk Management Framework, RMF. And the Risk Management Framework is, to me, a very interesting notion. At its heart, although the initial use case clearly is cybersecurity and risk reducing vulnerabilities, which I'll come back to in a minute, at its very notion, though, the foundation of it is connecting, making visible and connecting, let me call it three layers here, the infrastructure layer at the bottom of our department to the business capability layer, let's say, at the middle, all the way up to the mission execution level at the top, explicit auditable connections. So those connections, which is enterprise architecture, all that will get documented in our enterprise architecture repository, et cetera. So at the heart of it, that's architecture I just described. Now, the use case, sure, for vulnerabilities. So anything down at the infrastructure level that is either becomes inoperable for any reason, could be because it's hacked or it could be because it simply breaks down, whatever. With that framework in place, we can identify the business capabilities that are impacted and that segment of the mission is going to be impacted.
Okay.
Likewise, however, when it comes to enhancing a certain part of, we want to improve mission execution in a certain area, we can use the same framework to identify which capabilities are implied in that, in strengthening that area of mission execution. And then from that, cascade down to what are the infrastructure prerequisites to actually improve that. So there's a resource management use case that is just as useful or valuable as the cybersecurity use case for that risk management framework. So I think that's the main connection, and it's going to, I think, provide us a lot of benefits.
I agree. I've seen a lot of organizations, and like you, DOD, and then going to VA and also some time at the EPA, but I've seen where EA wasn't as utilized as it should. Mm-hmm. And I think it's such an important component for cybersecurity, really. I mean, it shows where all the connections are. Mm-hmm. And so, no, it's good to hear that. But you're also a doctor. Mm-hmm. So you're an IT executive, but you're also a physician. Mm-hmm. As we go into a more connected society, mm-hmm. our EMR is, you know, with meaningful use, high tech, and going on to the next layers of this is becoming more and more connected. What, as it relates to that in cybersecurity, does it concern you with patient care?
Well, certainly information protection, but I would say two aspects to it, to that. One is the various roles that a person, provider of some sort, could be physician, nurse, pharmacist, emergency room technician, you name it, what that role is supposed to be able to do by way of privileges to accessing data and applications, but particularly the data. So role-based access control becomes a very important risk mitigator. It's an interesting one. Let me add to that, though, role-based access control at the data element level. So that becomes a very interesting concept, of course, for cybersecurity perspective, that only the right person can get to only the right data at only the right time. If you properly classify roles, user classes, if you will, and if you properly tag the data, and then you match the tags to the roles. The other interesting thing about role-based access control, however, is those same tags, the roles and the tags, can actually be used to facilitate workflow. So, for example, a physician or a clinic administrator knows which patients are going to come in tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. Well, with the role of the provider known and the data that provider needs for that work tagged, all of that data can be prefetched the night before and put in some nearline storage, even in memory, if now within memory computing, so that 8 o'clock in the morning, everything is lightning fast. If the patient shows up that you expected to show up, everything is there already prefetched. So, and of course, you can accommodate walk-ins and all that kind of stuff. There's always exceptions. But at the 70, 80, 90% rule, prefetch all the data. So the interesting thing about role-based access control, in my mind, at the data element level, it can both strengthen cybersecurity and facilitate workflow. It is, for the first time that I have come across, a cybersecurity notion that actually facilitates workflow.
And that's where we should be.
Right. So single sign-on, in a certain sense, does the same thing, because now actually when people start using it, they come to realize they don't have to memorize 35 passwords. So in a certain sense, that facilitates workflow as well. But so will role-based access control.
Are you seeing this anywhere yet in practice?
Why do we bring this up? Why do I bring this up here? And no, I'm concerned that industry in general is not moving fast enough in that direction to make that a facile notion to implement. We're getting there. We have tools to help us define roles, and certainly tagging of data is well understood, sure. But when you get to the complexity of matching the tags to the roles, things can get pretty complicated. And I think we would do better with more tools, more industry products, more commercial off-the-shelf products to help us execute, bring that notion to reality easier than we do now.
No, agreed. So in your career, you've gone from the paper-based record to CACS, to Alta, to Vista, and now we're entering a phase of a whole new paradigm of EMRs. Mm-hmm. Excited?
Oh, it's very exciting, for sure. It's not my direct responsibility now, right? Because I'm focused on finance. But healthcare is going to have financial implications as well, right? So one of the most exciting things I'd say about it, always has been and still is, by the way, even moving forward, it's kind of an ongoing challenge, which I find interesting and, invigorating, is to try to tie test and treatments, the decisions that the healthcare providers make, to the resources, to the outcome, and then those outcomes to the resources consumed. So when you get to the resources consumed, of course, you come back to FMBT and what I'm doing, right? So getting the right linkages in place, getting the right concepts in place first, and then the right linkages in place to say, to treat pneumonia in California, we did these five things. To treat pneumonia in Florida, we did a different five things. Was the outcome of the pneumonia just as good? And which of the five things were less expensive or more expensive if the outcome was just as good? That to me is really exciting. And, I would say every day we're closer and closer and closer to being able to do that with the new tools and new techniques and the new level of interest that keeps growing in being able to perform those kind of analyses.
All right. My guest today is Dr. Paul Tibbetts, Program Executive Officer for the Financial Management Business Transformation Program at the Department of Veteran Affairs. I am Sean Kelly, and this is Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You know, the mantra in Washington is follow the money. Everybody says it, hardly anybody does it. But we do. Every week on Your Turn with Mike Causey. Whether it's your pay raise, a major change to your retirement package, or the chances of layoffs, we're on it. Because we really do follow the money, and it's your money. Give us a listen Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., or download it anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Your Turn.
Welcome back to Cyber Chat on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 a.m. My guest today is Dr. Paul Tibbetts, Program Executive Officer for the Financial Management Business Transformation Program at the Department of Veteran Affairs. Dr. Tibbetts, we hear about Internet of Things, but in medicine, we have medical devices. How do we tackle the medical device problem in hospitals as it relates to cybersecurity?
Right. Well, I would say at least on two levels. It's a very important question. We have medical devices, medical IoT, if you will, all over the place, and is only going to continue to grow. I mean, certainly from my sense of our surroundings in healthcare and otherwise. Two areas. Our own architecture. We have created, I think, what we would best call a medical device isolation architecture. It actually has been awarded prizes. The Federal Health IT Group, I think, in last year, I believe, gave an innovation award to VA for that concept.
Okay.
So trying to keep those devices more or less cordoned off, so if malware gets into them, we can identify what subsegment of the network that where that's emanating from, isolate it off until it gets quarantine it until it gets fixed and remediated and whatnot. So that's our own architecture approach, you could say. The other is our collaboration with industry. So some of our more forward-leaning thought leaders in the department have established now, I'd say going back perhaps 2 or 3 years, relationships with these device manufacturers to start them and in a collaborative way down the pathway of building cybersecurity thinking and therefore the architecture itself into the products when those products are manufactured so that downstream they can be patched and work through all those issues of not just the device itself, but the regulatory superstructure with the FDA to work through all that stuff to keep those devices, build them in a secure way to begin with, and then keep them secure over time. So I'd say those two levels is what we're working. Our own architecture and internal to the VA and the collaboration with industry, the device manufacturers.
No, agreed. I mean, we've talked to FDA on the show, and we know that medical devices can be on the network from 7 to 15 years. So obviously the world's our world changes very rapidly when it comes to that. So, you know, that's good to hear. And it's not so much a static environment, but it's also what you're saying is a dynamic environment that will allow to keep pace as they stay on the network longer and longer.
That's exactly right. And more dynamism is necessary in that regard for the purpose you state, exactly, to keep up with the vulnerabilities, keep up with the new protective mechanisms, and make sure those are either built in when we first buy the thing or install it, and then kept up to speed over time.
Absolutely. Yeah, because it's a huge capital investment. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars, you know, for
and
healthcare systems.
And potentially a very large attack surface.
Oh, great. It is.
Right.
So who is Paul Tibbetts outside of the VA and the FMBT, and what do you like to do?
Well, the thing I guess that, I guess I still, because of my physician background, I suppose, I still keep my initial focus, if you will say, I guess you could say, on patients, but it's in our case now more directly veteran well-being. And that plays out in various ways. I'm very interested in trying to measure the extent to which our initiatives have a positive impact on veteran well-being. There is now language in the latest omnibus appropriation, by the way, with respect to FMBT, that requires us to measure our performance against an established baseline. Are we eliminating miscellaneous obligations and those improper payments, et cetera, those things that are the obvious good consequences that FMBT is intended to accomplish. But beyond that, I really enjoy trying to working with Scott Blackburn, John Rychalski, the chief learning officer at VHA, Jim Warner, on trying to put in place a set of metrics to actually link to measure veteran well-being, but in a way that we can connect it back to the investments we're making in information technology. So that's one area. The other that I find very intriguing in this program is business process reengineering. Mm-hmm. And we're putting, as I mentioned earlier, we're putting a lot of investment into that. We're not modifying the COTS product. We're modifying people and our processes instead.
Agreed.
Because we want the federal best practices in finance and acquisition. You mentioned several large programs before, two of which I was in charge of, right, CHES and ALTA. And actually, when I was the program executive officer at DOD, I was in charge of several other large, the DIMLs and several other large programs as well. none of those programs had, well, it was many of them, had no business process reengineering on the front end. I will say in the case of logisticians, they were always the best at incorporating IT into their new supply chain management practices. So they were always a beacon of a good example of how to treat IT. But most programs don't do that. I'm very happy, and to my knowledge, certainly our prior attempts at ERP replacement here at VA didn't do that either. Yeah. So I'm really impressed with the way our comptroller business partners put together the program with the amount of effort that we're putting into business process reengineering on the front end of this program. It's an excellent approach.
You also were a huge advocate when I was at the VA for human-centered design.
Yes, so thank you. So, and I still advocate for it pretty much in some way every day. We're looking for pilot opportunities. Right now, of course, some of our programs in the Veteran Experience Office are using human-centered design already, but I'm looking for opportunities to spread that approach more broadly across VA. So right now, for example, in FMBT, we're designing reports. Well, not just the annual consolidated financial statements, but the ad hoc reports that somebody might need on a quarterly basis or a monthly basis or a weekly basis, or how much does pneumonia cost to treat in California versus Florida, et cetera, et cetera. Well, designing reports is an interesting opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I've approached our business partners who are convening all the running the activities to design those reports to say, can we take a subset of those and try a human-centered design approach? So we're trying to explore that right now to see if we can do that in a way that we get more people familiar with the approach. I want to say that at the heart of human-centered design is empathetic observation.
I agree.
And empathetic observation, particularly in the people business that we're in VA, serving our staff, but also therefore helping our staff serve veterans. To me, empathetic observation is a key concept that if we can spread that more broadly across all of our activities, I think we'll be better off and we'll strengthen our approach to serving veterans even better than we're doing now. I think it would just add a lot. Empathetic observation.
I even think that there's a place for human-centered design within the cybersecurity realm. And how do we, as we talked about, how do we enable the business with cybersecurity? And sure. So I think those are important concepts as well.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's interesting when someone pushes back and says, no, we can't do this and can't do that because it disrupts our workflow. I mean, in a certain sense, pushback really represents interest. And if we started identifying those people who were resistors as actually interested enough to say something, we should start capitalizing on those relationships and start engaging them, exactly, the activist, in the human-centered design.
My guest today has been Dr. Paul Tibbetts, Program Executive Officer for the Financial Management Business Transformation Program at the Department of Veteran Affairs. I am Sean Kelly. Thank you for listening. You can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Sean Kelly. We will see you next month.
You've been listening to Cyber Chat with Sean Kelly. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show at federalnewsradio.com. Search Cyber Chat. One-on-one interviews with executives who manage the inner workings of the Defense Department. federalnewsradio.com. Search on DOD.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is all ages read together, educating children in need with free preschool programs in their communities. All ages read together fills the gap left by publicly funded programs for 4 and 5 year olds whose families can't afford private preschool. Classes provide a nurturing experience to build confidence and include a featured book each week that goes home with every child. Help change the lives of underprivileged children in our area. Learn more and make a donation at allagesreadtogether.org.
Tune in each weekday morning at 6. Tom Temin brings you the latest agency news from across the government, reports on congressional action, and developments affecting your pay and benefits. Hear interviews with people making, analyzing, and helping you understand the news. Start off your weekday informed and stimulated. It's The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, weekday mornings at 6 here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Get a heads up on the technology powering the federal government. Go to federalnewsradio.com, search Federal Tech Talk. WFED Washington, WTOP FM HD2 Washington, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights, Frederick, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.